Hello and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. The cryptocurrency Bitcoin has had a wild year. The value of one Bitcoin was nearly maybe $1,000 at the beginning of 2017. Well, today, one Bitcoin is worth somewhere around $17,000. It rose even higher to about $20,000 on some exchanges in the last few days. Security regulator Joseph Borg says Bitcoin is in what he calls a mania phase. Here's a clip of him on CNBC.
Computer code.
Well, we've seen mortgages being taken out to buy Bitcoin.
You have?
What? Yes.
Come on.
Sure. People borrow money.
Look, you're saying people take equity lines out?
Yeah.
To buy?
Sure.
Holy smokes.
People do credit cards, equity lines.
Me.
What they haven't figured out. You know what I got this morning in an email? This morning, before I showed up on the show, I got a guy who says to me, guaranteed $13,000 profit, buy Bitcoin right now in one day.
That was Joseph Borg, president of the North American Securities Administrators Association, and that was on CNBC this past Monday. Bitcoin isn't the only cryptocurrency, but it's certainly the leading one, and it's ushering a new wave of decentralized digital currency that uses cryptography for security. So, how do cryptocurrencies work? What is causing this rapid rise in value? Is this run-up just a bubble, or is there something more consequential happening here? To help answer all of those questions is reporter Nathaniel Popper. He joins me in studio. Nathaniel covers finance and technology from San Francisco for the New York Times. He is the author of the book Digital Gold, Bitcoin and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. Gotta love that title. Before joining the Times, he was a reporter at the LA Times and at the Forward. Nathaniel Popper, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you right here in San Francisco. And for all of the nephews and nieces and aunties and uncles and friends and neighbors who knew that I was going to be doing this show today, who sent me in here with a cheat sheet full of questions. Let's just start with the most basic. How did this begin? How did the whole idea of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin get started?
That's a good place to start, rather than the technical details, which can sometimes be a little mind-numbing. What's important to remember about Bitcoin is that it was put out into the world in 2008 by a creator who is still, the identity of whom is still not known. A guy went by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto. Actually, we don't know if it's a guy or girl or a group of people. But put this idea out into the world just about a month after the crash of Lehman Brothers. So right in the middle of the financial crisis, this came out. And the idea was, here is a new sort of kind of money, a new financial network that is going to be independent of all of these banks and governments that you distrust. That was the original idea. Let's create a sort of new financial system outside the control of any of these traditional authorities.
And the time was certainly ripe after the banks crashed and insurance companies crashed. And so people had kind of lost their confidence in those institutions, right? So it was a good time.
I think even still, that has been a thread that has run throughout the history of Bitcoin. But I think you even see it today. I think even in the last year, you've seen this idea spread around the world. And a lot of, I think, what's fueling this is still this sense that I don't trust the authorities anymore. I want to sort of take power back. And sort of taking your money back is a pretty fundamental way in which you can do that. And that's the thing that Bitcoin promises, at least. Now, whether it upholds that promise, whether it can do everything it promised is, what we can discuss here today. But I think sort of remembering that that's where this idea came from is really puts it in perspective.
Okay. Swell idea. But how do you start something like that? How did it begin?
Yeah. It really began with some software that this Satoshi Nakamoto sent out to a small listserv. The system sort of word into life in January 2009. And at the time, there was, you know, maybe a dozen people who had downloaded the software and began running it. And really, for the first 2 years, that it had essentially no following. You know, Satoshi Nakamoto at one point almost lost interest and sort of shut it down. He stopped participating for a while. A kid in Finland actually sort of kept the project going for a while when nobody had any interest in it. But even during those first 2 years, you had a network of computers that were plugged into this Bitcoin software, Bitcoin network, all kind of communicating and creating Bitcoins. Every 10 minutes, new Bitcoins would be released onto the network to one of these computers that was participating.
Now, when you say create Bitcoin, we're not talking about a printing press printing off currency. How do you create a Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Is it a series? My understanding is that it's literally a string of alphanumeric numbers somewhere in the universe.
Yeah. Well, so a Bitcoin is certainly there's no physical, you know, there's no physical backing for it. There's no physical representation of it. There's no Bitcoin bill. You have a digital wallet, which is really a lot like an email address that's yours. And you have a password called a private key in Bitcoin that allows you to access any Bitcoins that are in that wallet. Now, how are Bitcoin created in the first place? In a way, that's one of the more complicated things to understand about Bitcoin, but it is also sort of at the heart of the system, and it's sort of what makes Bitcoin work. The way Bitcoins are created is a process that you've probably heard of called Bitcoin mining. And it's all of these computers that are joined into the network, essentially in a sort of mathematical computational race to win new Bitcoin as they're released. And the reason that that is useful to the network is because the race involves actually collecting all the incoming transactions and recording them. So these computers that are getting the new Bitcoins are also serving as the accountants for the network. They're the ones writing down each new Bitcoin, each person who's sending a Bitcoin from one wallet to another. They're the ones keeping the records. And because you have this network of people keeping the records, you don't need any one institution to stand in the middle of the system. Instead, it's sort of distributed around the world.
So Federal Reserve banks issue currency, fiat currency. When you say release a Bitcoin, who's releasing Bitcoins?
It requires a sort of step of abstraction. But on the first day when Bitcoin began, there were no Bitcoins in the world. There was no pre-existing pot of Bitcoin that were handed out to people. Bitcoin are created literally when everybody on the network writes down at the same time, this wallet has a Bitcoin. This wallet is given 50 new Bitcoins. This person or computer won the race. They are given a block of Bitcoins. And everybody on the network agrees to update their records to say that person has 50 Bitcoins. That's literally how the Bitcoin come into existence. And frankly, it is not that different than how a bank creates money, which is that they write in your account, you have $50. When they give you a loan, that the money for that loan did not previously exist. They write in there, you now have $10,000 to buy this house. Similarly with Bitcoin, they come into existence when everybody writes onto the records that they come into existence. They're not given out from some pot. It's everybody on the network sort of agreeing to this at the same time. And it's kind of mind-bending and
yeah,
it makes a lot of people kind of grimace or wince. And I think that part of the system at least is the part that really has worked. There are a lot of parts of the system that at various points haven't worked as well as expected, but that part at least has worked because it's incentivized people to join the network and it's incentivized them to keep track of the records for the network, to be the accountants for the network.
So in many ways, it's the same thing as online banking. It's all virtual anyway. Is that the point?
Well, certainly almost all dollars are already digital. So our money is already digital. There's no backing for it. There aren't bills or gold backing up most dollars that we have. It's just entries on a ledger. Similarly, Bitcoin are just entries on a ledger. The difference between Bitcoin and dollars is that instead of that ledger being kept by a bank or one institution, it's kept by this network. So it's kind of like the difference between Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica. Instead of one company making Encyclopedia Britannica, with Wikipedia, you have this network of people sort of using the hive mind, and it works. It works surprisingly well, at least.
Well, I must say it sort of sounds a bit Rise of the Machine-y to me, but...
It certainly is. I mean, this is a network that's being controlled by computers that are sort of acting autonomously. And one of the ideas here is that this will be the money for the robots of the future. This is how your autonomous car is going to pay for parking, you know, pay the parking meter, which is its own, you know, autonomous being in a sense. I mean, that's part of the idea here, is that you're going to have a purely digital money that doesn't require human involvement. We're a long way from that, but that's part of what makes people so excited about this.
Or frightened.
And frightened. Mm-hmm. People, I mean, one of the, you know, in covering Bitcoin for years now and writing the book, I think one of the reasons, one of the things that's kept me holding on, I'm not invested in it. I can't buy Bitcoins. But what keeps me holding on is just how kind of what a rise it gets out of people. I mean, it evokes these incredibly strong emotions because it's tapping into this really elemental thing, which is money. And it makes you kind of rethink what is money? How does money work? How do we ascribe value to things? And it, again, it provokes this incredibly strong feeling, some good, some bad. But, you know, the number of people who I saw in the course of writing my book who kind of, you know, threw their old lives behind and went to sort of chase this dream, which, you know, they believed could both make them rich and change the world. That was what has sort of kept me hanging on, and the degree to which it's an experiment. We don't know where it's going to go. You know, nobody at the beginning of the year would have anticipated that Bitcoin would be worth as much as they are, that people would be mortgaging their houses to buy them. And you know, the number of sort of dramatic twists and turns in the history of Bitcoin is just remarkable. It's really sort of a story of our times and this sort of technological moment that we're going through.
And you said you can't invest. Is that because you are a journalist and you want to stay objective about it?
Yeah. I mean, basically, we decided early on that it's sort of like covering a company. You can't own stock in a company that you're covering because you don't want to have any interest in the company doing well or poorly. You want to be independent. You want to, if it fails, fine. If it succeeds, fine. I mean, that's the perspective I still take to it. You know, I try very hard, and I think I'm not, you know, an advocate for Bitcoin, but I'm very interested in explaining why it's interesting.
Is it safe to say that you would if you could?
No. I mean, if for no other reason, then I do know that I'm a terrible investor and I would buy at the wrong moment and sell at the wrong moment. So I'm probably pretty thankful that I don't have that ability.
Well, part of, I think, what's attracting people is that there's a limited supply. Buy now. Is it true there's only 21 million Bitcoins in existence?
Well, so that the original software, you know, that was released by Satoshi Nakamoto back in 2009 set down the rules for the network that everybody downloaded. And those original rules said only 21 million will ever be created. They're, as we've discussed through mining, they're handed out in blocks every 10 minutes. So we are now, up till now, about 17 million of those 21 million have been released. It kind of goes down. The number that is released every 10 minutes goes down by half every 4 years. And so you get smaller and smaller returns, you know, people joining the network. And it's anticipated that the last Bitcoin will be released in the year 2140. So this is a long process, a long, slow process. But you do have this cap on the number that will ever be released. And everybody who has the software has those rules. And that's sort of one of these fundamental rules for how the network works.
One publication indicates that only about 1.8% of Bitcoins are circulating on the network, and the remaining 98.2% are lying in accounts somewhere waiting and anticipating growth. Is that about right?
Yes. I mean, the way people are viewing this today is as a speculative investment. There's no question about it. They're buying it and hoping that it will go up in price. And that's more true now than it's ever been. And that's an interesting evolution because at the beginning when Bitcoin was released, part of the idea was that this was going to be a new kind of electronic cash, a new way to make electronic transactions that would be cheaper and more efficient than credit cards. And you know, the original paper from Satoshi Nakamoto talked about this idea that we want a better way to make electronic transactions. Over time, it seems that it's less good at doing that, or at least in its current design, and has been more attractive as this kind of gold-like thing that people invest in and just sit on. And you know, the argument that's made is that it's like gold, but it's better because it's easier to send around. You don't have to store it in a vault somewhere, ostensibly. But it's very scarce, and anybody in the world with internet access can get at it. And there's no authority who can take it away from you. And so that's kind of the premise that a lot of people, I think, are investing on these days, is that it's a sort of electronic a digital gold, like the title of my book. And so that's a real change. But I think there is a vision that ultimately people want to turn this into more of a kind of electronic money that you're using to pay for things. But that's not happening today.
Well, needless to say, lots of folks have questions about cryptocurrency. So what questions do you have about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general? Have you invested in Bitcoin already? There are some other cryptocurrencies out there. Have you looked into those? And what are your thoughts on the whole premise? Are you a business that accepts cryptocurrencies? And what are your thoughts? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can drop us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. Nathaniel Popper is here, and he's got the answers. You know, can we do a quick glossary? Three words that I keep hearing over and over. Cryptocurrency. What is it? Brief definition.
Yeah, well, cryptocurrency is this idea that Bitcoin introduced, which is a currency that's sort of backed by cryptography and math. So that's the kind of that's the infrastructure that makes all these crazy things work is cryptography. And those
an
ideas, and those ideas now have been used to create other cryptocurrencies with similar designs, tweaks to improve on Bitcoin, to create different qualities in Bitcoin. And so now you have actually thousands of cryptocurrencies that people are making bets on or thinking that this will solve some problem that Bitcoin didn't solve.
I've heard of Litecoin and Ethereum. Are those the newcomers, up-and-comers?
Yeah, I mean, those are kind of the grandparents in the space. Mm. They are indeed newer than Bitcoin and recently have been increasing in value just as fast as Bitcoin. But, you know, you have this list of literally hundreds and hundreds, and every day new ones are created. And everybody's making bets on which ones are going to succeed. And the reality is that almost all of them will fail.
Next glossary term, mining.
Mining is the method through which new Bitcoins are created. You know, so we talked about this a little bit earlier. How do people get new Bitcoins? It's this sort of communal process of record keeping, a computational race. So these computers around the world are doing this work to try to unlock new Bitcoin. So it's sort of like mining gold, except here you're doing computational work.
And blockchain, what does that mean?
Blockchain is very simply the ledger, the sort of spreadsheet on which all Bitcoin transactions are recorded. So it's a lot like a bank ledger, except this ledger, the blockchain, is kept by a network of computers.
You know, it occurs to me that with this approach, you can pretty much be your own bank. You are your own bank, except that this only exists as a series of alphanumeric numbers somewhere on your laptop. Lose your laptop, lose your money. Yes,
yep. That's you stated it pretty well right there. And the idea of being your own bank is one of the things that people say when they're arguing for Bitcoin. But as you just pointed out, you might not want to be your own bank. You might not want to be in charge of the keys to the vault, because it turns out that a lot of people aren't very good at protecting the keys to their vaults, aren't very good at protecting their passwords. If somebody gets onto your laptop and hacks in and gets your private key to your Bitcoin wallet, those Bitcoins are gone. And unlike a bank account where you keep your dollars, there's no reversing the transactions, no getting that back, and it's not insured. So when it's gone, it's gone.
Why would anyone take a risk like that? Because Bitcoin has been hacked, hasn't it? People have lost millions of Bitcoins.
Well, Bitcoin itself, the software, hasn't been hacked. And that's why people are still betting on it. But a lot of the services that are built on top of Bitcoin have been hacked. So a lot of the exchanges where you can buy Bitcoin that are already in the world, a lot of the wallets have been hacked. Why would you want to do that? I think the answer lies in the numbers that you gave at the beginning of the show. It was worth $1,000 at the beginning of the year, and it's worth $17,000 now. There was no other investment in the world that you could have gotten that kind of returns on this year or most other years either. Now, that is not at all a guaranteed thing that will continue. Chances are, if past patterns are any guide, it's going to go down. But that kind of risk, those kinds of rewards are, the kinds of risks go with the kind of rewards that seem to be available.
But why do you think it's growing so rapidly? What's driving up the value like this?
Well, there are a ton of factors that have driven up Bitcoin this year. There's, some of the sort of philosophical stuff we've been talking about. But on a practical level, on the philosophical level, I think the idea this year is that here is this asset, a digital asset that's scarce for the first time that anybody in the world can access. There's not really another asset that anybody else in the world can access. People in China can't buy American stocks or American real estate very easily. It's not easy to buy gold. This is something that anybody in the world can access. And what you've seen this year is that people all in all of these different places around the world have gotten excited about this. So actually the most active places for trading right now are actually Japan and Korea. A year ago, it was China. The Chinese government cracked down, and a lot of people thought, "Oh no, there goes Bitcoin." And as China was kind of fading from the scene, Japan and Korea, these retail investors, ordinary people, started getting really excited about this. In the United States, the new thing is hedge funds and Wall Street that are getting excited about this. They're saying, "We don't want to miss out on this." And so, actually, just this week, you have the first Bitcoin futures being traded, essentially a kind of Wall Street grade contract that allows you to bet on the price of Bitcoin. And two exchanges in Chicago are rolling that out this week. One already has done it and there's trading right now. And then the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is about to roll that out. So that is allowing Wall Street to get involved for the first time. Wall Street has been avoiding this because of all the kind of problems around it. But there's this sense, I think everybody just has this sense that, I don't want to miss out on this.
But what you're doing, it's speculative. And so now that it's on trading in futures, what if people start buying short, betting that it'll go down, which of course can drive it down?
Yeah. No, I mean, that is part of the idea of creating futures is that people can short it. So people who don't believe in this can say, I'm going to bet that the price is going to go down. Now, the reality is, in the way the contract is structured so far, it's actually still pretty hard to short it. But that's the idea. People are going to go short. And the question is going to be, are there going to be an equal number of people who will go long? And it's going to be a tug of war. And there's been that tug of war already in Bitcoin. And that's why the price whipsaws in the way that it does. And it is absolutely a speculative asset, a speculative investment. And a lot of the kind of big ideas behind it are still things that people are betting on in the future. But I will say, I think one thing this year has proven is that it does have this fundamental quality that it is something that is essentially accessible to anybody anywhere in the world. And that's new. So even the people who are speculating on it, that comes with a lot of problems and risks and everything. But they're showing that, somebody in Japan can have this thing and then sell it to somebody in the United States who sells it to somebody in Venezuela. And a lot of the the promise of this is in places like Venezuela or Zimbabwe, where the local currency doesn't work very well. And maybe this looks a little more attractive. If your local currency is very risky, this is that much more attractive to you. For us living in the United States, you know, we have a pretty stable currency. We have good bank accounts. But there are a lot of people in the world who don't have easy access to bank accounts, who have a local currency that, you know, declines in value every year. And so for them, maybe this risk, they're a little bit more willing to take this risk.
Now, you see, I get that. I've been to Zimbabwe several times, and it's astonishing. First of all, you have to bring a suitcase into the store full of the Zimbabwe dollars, and you get to the store, and maybe you're going to buy some fruit. From the time you walk in the door to the time you go and select the apples and get to the counter, the price has gone from 7 million Zimbabwe dollars to 11 million Zimbabwe dollars. So it's inflationary. There's no confidence behind it. So I can really see where this would really be attractive in a situation like that.
You don't need a suitcase to carry these around.
Interesting. But I'll bet that this is really making banks really nervous and some governments really nervous. So why are those institutions perhaps really concerned about this? And what are the implications of the rapid rise in value in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies? We're going to keep up the conversation with Nathaniel Popper, and we'll take your calls right after this. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. There you can also listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. And we love it when you have show ideas for us. Drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. Tomorrow, we have the weekly media roundtable. Lots of stories in the news this week, and we'll talk about how those stories were covered. Today, we are talking about Bitcoin. As of today, it's worth almost $17,000. The cryptocurrency has shot up rapidly in value. Last month alone, it was worth only about $7,000. So there are now reports of people mortgaging their homes and taking out lines of credit to try to get in on the action. But just what is Bitcoin? What are cryptocurrencies? Why has the value run up so quickly? What questions do you have about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies? Join us at 866-798-8255. Nathaniel Popper is the author of Digital Gold, Bitcoin and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. Let's start with an email from Leslie. Leslie writes, you keep referring to quote-unquote buying Bitcoin. How does one buy Bitcoin? Nathaniel Popper.
Well, it's not difficult. It's essentially sort of the same process as buying a share of a stock. You know, you don't buy the share of a stock from the company. Similarly, with Bitcoin, you don't buy the Bitcoin, you know, new Bitcoin. You buy Bitcoin that have already been released into the world to these miners, and they sell them on exchanges around the world. Most countries now, most large countries, have their own Bitcoin exchanges. The United States has a couple of actually regulated Bitcoin exchanges. And the most popular one here is a company called Coinbase that essentially is like the Charles Schwab of Bitcoin. You go, you input your bank account, you transfer money to them, and they sell you a Bitcoin at, you know, the current price. And amazingly, Coinbase, over the last few weeks, has been the number one most downloaded app on the iPhone at various points, has overtaken Charles Schwab in the number of customer accounts that it has. It now has something in the neighborhood of 14 million accounts compared to Charles Schwab, which has 13 million customers. The flip side of that is that Coinbase has been sort of overwhelmed by the traffic and has been, basically shut down at various points. The servers have stopped working. You know, people have been trying to put through orders, sell Bitcoin, and it hasn't been going through. So, you know, it shows how sort of young this whole technology still is. It's, you know, a lot of people who believe in the technology think it's really not ready for the way it's gone mainstream over the last year.
Banks are kind of nervous about this, aren't they? Why?
Well, yeah. I mean, banks have a lot of complicated feelings towards this. A lot of the line you frequently hear from bankers is, we're not interested in Bitcoin, but we're interested in the technology that Bitcoin introduced, this blockchain idea, this new way of recording transactions. And a lot of banks, essentially every bank, has made an investment in this space at trying to create new blockchains that banks will use that will cut out their middlemen. So instead of having to go through the New York Stock Exchange, they can buy and sell stock. You know, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley can trade directly with each other without needing somebody in the middle. And so they're experimenting with the technology. But, you know, what's interesting is that Bitcoin, you know, a lot of them made this bet that Bitcoin's not going to matter. We're going to end up using this technology, but it's not going to be Bitcoin. In the end, Bitcoin has boomed in this way that's making it so that they can't ignore Bitcoin. And that's why we see these sort of futures starting to trade this week, and banks really are starting to have to get involved.
And they're kind of losing control of the money supply. This cuts out the banks. It cuts out central banks. I mean,
original idea. And so, yes, they, you know, this was aimed directly at Wall Street. Remember, as we said, this was mm-hmm. this was created right in the wake of the financial crisis, and it was aimed at cutting out these middlemen that we have in our lives. So, you know, there is a degree to which they might see this as a threat. I mean, I think it's still too small for them to really view this as, you know, people are going to put it here instead of in a bank account. But this year, that's starting to shift. There are young people who are choosing to put their money into Bitcoin instead of into a bank account or a stock fund.
My nephew was moving things around, and the bank kind of put a halt to it. Like, wait a minute, what are you doing? So, again, it makes banks nervous. But one reason people trust banks is because if something happens up to, I don't know, $250,000 or $25,000 or whatever, it's guaranteed.
Yeah.
This has no guarantee. But there is also no regulation. It's like the Wild West out there.
Yeah. I mean, it very much is. I mean, you know, people sometimes compare this to the tech bubble of the 1990s. I think it's probably more like the kind of wildcat era of the railroads in the 1800s. I mean, there's literally nobody who knows sort of how to tame this system. Regulators are getting involved, particularly in the United States and Japan. And in China, the authorities have just said, you know what, you have to they essentially cut off trading for ordinary people earlier this year because it had gotten into such a frenzy. But people, the way that Bitcoin's built, it kind of just moves around these various impediments and obstacles because, you know, all you need to get at it is internet access.
So there are no consumer protections. I mean, how do you back it up? Once again, if you've lost your laptop, you've lost your money. So are there no consumer protections?
Well, there are ways to secure your Bitcoin beyond just storing it on your laptop. There are a lot of elaborate systems that people use to keep backup private keys, to avoid hackers. And, you know, there's an evolving set of practices around that people use. You know, if you're smart, you can secure these things, and companies like Coinbase will hold your Bitcoin for you, and you know they have very smart security people there. They have, you know, some of the best security people around, and they to a degree offer an insurance for your accounts. But really, you know, if your account gets hacked and it's happened and the Bitcoin leave your account, it's hard to get them back. And so that is, you know, that danger is always lurking over you.
So ultimately, how do you look at cryptocurrencies? Is it ultimately going to be a way to pay for things or a stable way to park your money?
I mean, you know, every 2 months, I think the kind of outlook changes and the expectations, even on the most sophisticated Silicon Valley investors, changes. And that's why I keep getting drawn back to this story and why I'm so fascinated by it, is that it's this living experiment and you don't know where it's going to go. You wouldn't have anticipated that this would be this thing in Japan and Korea that was like a national frenzy. You know, there are storefronts in Korea where you can go in and trade cryptocurrencies. And a lot of people in Korea, they're not even interested in Bitcoin anymore. They want to trade Ethereum and Ripple and Bitcoin Cash and all of these alternatives. And you just don't know where it's going. I think what what seems to be interesting is that there are a lot of people. It's drawn in an incredible number of people who are trying to figure out how to tame this technology and to do something useful with it. And I think that something useful is going to come out of it. Already you have this kind of account, this sort of speculative asset that anybody can access. But people are trying to use this to move money, you know, to move remittance payments to India without the fees that Western Union charges. People are trying to create new networks so that you can make, you know, penny payments online, so you can pay for an article without subscribing for a whole year. You know, new businesses are cropping up, and people are trying these new things. And I think some of it is going to work. I think this is going to matter. I think how it's going to matter is still really unclear, and part of what makes it so fascinating to follow.
Sounds like the early days in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Like you can bet on a winner or it could turn out to be a loser.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, one of the analogies people make is to the early internet. And there was an argument with the early internet. Is this going to be more about, you know, messaging? You know, maybe are people going to send each other messages? Maybe it'll be about transferring, you know, information and articles and media, or maybe it'll be more about transactions. And, you know, in the end with the internet, obviously all of those things ended up coming true because of the number of people who were drawn to building on top of it. And you certainly have that level of energy around Bitcoin. So far, most of it still is unproven. But the fact that you have so many smart people sort of working on this, again, suggests that something's going to happen. And, you know, it might not be surprising if it does a lot of these different things. If one design of it ends up becoming the new credit card, and one design of it ends up becoming the new gold, and one design of it ends up becoming a new way to tip online. You know, when you go on Reddit and somebody makes a post you like, you can give them a nickel. That's very hard to do today, but there's a vision that this is going to allow that sort of thing in the future.
We're talking to Nathaniel Popper, and he works for the New York Times based here in San Francisco, and he's author of Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. We have an email from Brian. Brian writes, does Nathaniel not surmise from his research that blockchain is a natural evolutionary outgrowth of computer networking and the internet? Network application development and international movement of value and currencies related to software designed to facilitate transactions have been for a long time a challenge for developers. Economy moves faster by freeing value from localized currencies, and then add to that the advent of an immutable record attached to each data record, and you free that transaction and other functionality from the network software. Like banks and governments. So how would Nathaniel contextualize Benjamin Netanyahu's recent comments about cryptocurrencies versus, say, Janet Yellen's recent comments? Clearly, this is someone who's been watching this develop.
Yes, that's a good sort of summary of what you might hear from a technical person of the promise they see in this.
Well, what did Benjamin Netanyahu say?
I actually, frankly, so many government officials and bankers have been opining on Bitcoin recently, and you know, probably half of them. I don't know what Netanyahu said. I didn't catch that. But half of them basically have said this is the new tulip bulb, and half of them have said this is really important and it might change the world.
The tulip bulb. Now you have to just briefly.
Yeah, I mean that was the kind of most famous speculative investment bubble in Dutch tulip bulbs, and you know, people thought that these tulip bulbs were going to have some incredible value, but what happened was this sort of psychological frenzy took over. And people started buying because the price was going up and hoping it would go up more. And certainly that's a lot of the people buying today are just hoping that the value is going to go up. They have no idea how the technology works. They have no thesis about how this is going to change the world. They're just hoping the value is going to go up.
Yeah. I'm thinking there's maybe a lot of urban myth out there. Have you heard the one about the guy in Florida who bought the yellow Lamborghini using Bitcoin?
Lamborghinis have a sort of special status in Bitcoin land. That's kind of like the iconic thing you buy when you become a Bitcoin millionaire is the Lambo. So it's become a kind of like meme in the Bitcoin world. And by the way, there are, particularly right now, a lot of new Bitcoin millionaires. You know, a lot of people who bought 1,000 of these maybe when they were worth a dollar, and that 1,000 is now worth not 170,000 or 17 million. Sorry, I'm struggling with the
How
math.
How many
there.
Zeros
yeah.
are we talking
but,
about? Yeah.
There are a lot of people sitting on a lot of gains, and some of them are cashing out to buy Lamborghinis and beachfront properties. And I just saw somebody bought a professional hockey team in Denmark, and is going to name it the Bitcoin Arena. A couple years ago, we had the Bitcoin Bowl. What's interesting is how many people are actually holding on. Even these early people who have made all this money, but who think, oh, this is only the beginning. You know, we've only started to tap the mainstream. And once it goes really mainstream, you know, that's when the real value is going to happen. And so these people who are not taking their gains and are sitting on their Bitcoin waiting for them to go up even more. That's a big bet to take at this point.
So why be a millionaire now when you can hold on to be a billionaire later?
Absolutely.
Maybe. You know, I'm starting to see ATMs pop up in the most unlikely places, corner stores and such. I've yet to actually walk up. I think I'll do that later today. But what happens at a Bitcoin ATM machine?
Bitcoin ATMs are a little funny because to a degree they defeat the whole purpose of Bitcoin, which is that you don't need to deal with cash and, you know, physical transactions. I mean, Bitcoin is about making frictionless digital transactions. And so, you know, why would you need an ATM for that? Now, the role that ATMs have played is they've made it somewhat easier to buy Bitcoin. Instead of setting up an online account and giving your bank account, you put $40 into an ATM and it spits out a little wallet and private key for you, which is $40 worth of Bitcoin. And you pay for that. You know, there's a fee attached to it. So it is an easy way to buy, you know, small quantity of Bitcoin, but it's hard to imagine that playing an important role in the Bitcoin economy if it exists in the future, because the whole idea here is maybe we won't need cash anymore. Maybe we don't need to, you know, deal with all the grubbiness of going up and putting in your numbers and getting the, you know, bills out. Part of the idea of Bitcoin is to do away with all that.
Well, our crack producer, Laura Flynn, tracked down what Benjamin Netanyahu did say about Bitcoin. He said, quote, it can replace banks.
That is a very sort of optimistic view of what's going to happen here. And, you know, if that happens, it's going to take a while yet. The technology is not there yet. It's going through a lot of growing pains right now. And again, right now, the main thing that it's doing is serving as this speculative asset, this place for people to put money in and store it. And it's not a great way to pay for things online yet, in part because it's so popular, the network is congested, it's hard to get transactions through. Benjamin Netanyahu is saying the same thing that a lot of Bitcoin believers are saying. They won over one more. And, you know, the interesting thing to see is the way Bitcoin progresses and kind of wins people over, turns skeptics into believers.
Well, in some cases, I think governments may have incentives to actually try to put the brakes on it, if that's possible. We have an email from Pat. She says, isn't Bitcoin a way of avoiding taxes? What will governments do to try to correct tax avoidance if they can? If they are able to avoid paying taxes on Bitcoin, society loses out, doesn't it?
Yes. All of that is true. If you buy Bitcoin, you know, on a Bitcoin ATM, nobody is going to know you bought those Bitcoins. And if, you know, they go up in price over the next year and then you sell them to somebody on the street and you make $2,000, nobody will know those transactions happened or who was behind them. They won't know that you made the money and you don't have to pay taxes on them. I mean, you don't you the IRS won't know that you have to pay taxes on them. You are legally compelled to pay taxes. The IRS has said that if you make money on Bitcoin transactions, you have to pay, you know, the capital gains there just like you would on any investment. But, you know, if the IRS doesn't know, there are certainly a lot of people who aren't going to tell the IRS. And I think a lot of people are viewing this as something of a tax shelter. This is the new Swiss bank account, you know, where you can park your money and nobody knows it's there. And that's a real issue for the authorities. You've seen actually this year, the IRS, one of the steps they've taken is they actually went to Coinbase, which is the brokerage service that has sold Bitcoins to most Americans. And they've said, hand over all your customer records. Hand over all the records for every Bitcoin you've sold, sold to somebody and bought from somebody. And Coinbase fought it. Actually, I think it was just 2 weeks ago, they announced the IRS said, okay, you only have to hand over the records for people who bought and sold at least $20,000 worth of Bitcoin. And those people, you can be sure, are going to be getting letters from the IRS saying, you know, pay the taxes on this. There are, though, a lot of other ways to buy Bitcoin where, you know, Coinbase isn't going to be recording your identity. And people will certainly use this as a way to dodge taxes.
Okay, we have a caller, Arturo. Thank you for hanging on. What's your question for Nathaniel?
Okay, let me just describe the source here. Now, about within the past 2 weeks, perhaps 3 weeks, BBC broadcast on KALW a discussion regarding bitcoins. It was about a half hour in length, perhaps, and included experts. The statement was made that the current power requirements for powering the computers to process bitcoin transactions, blockchain transactions, account for would power a medium-sized European country. And by 2020, the power requirements would be that of the United States. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Arturo. I've read that, too, that right about now, the amount of electricity it takes would power the country of Denmark. And as Arturo said, by 2020, it'll take up the entire amount of power that it uses that it takes to power the entire United States grid. So
that's this is a very active debate recently. You know, the way Bitcoin works is that these computers do this computational work to try to win Bitcoin. And as Bitcoin are worth more, people put more computers on to are willing to spend more on electricity to win these Bitcoins. It does create this incredible energy suck. Now, the question is sort of what are the long-term consequences of that? What you will hear from Bitcoin believers is that a lot of that energy is being used in places where energy is really cheap and maybe renewable. So there are a lot of Bitcoin facilities actually set up in Iceland to use geothermal energy there that wouldn't be used otherwise. People set them up near water dams to get, you know, cheap hydroelectric power. And the process is becoming more efficient over time. The computational process is becoming more efficient. But there's no question that this is true and that it's going to take a lot of power. And the argument that they simply make is, you know what, it takes a lot of power to mine gold. You see stats that it takes less power to mine the same value of Bitcoin as it does to mine the same value of gold. But it's a real issue that this sort of technology needs to confront.
But for now, it certainly only makes sense in a society that can generate electricity.
Yes.
Okay, we've got one more quick caller before we have to start saying goodbye. Hi, Donald, it's you.
Hello. What is it like?
Is it like a penny?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I want to know.
It is not like a penny. There is no physical Bitcoin. You know, you sometimes see these pictures of Bitcoins there. Those are really just novelty objects. Bitcoin are just, you know, entries on a ledger, and they can be subdivided out to the eighth decimal point. So, you know, people can't afford a Bitcoin anymore, but you can afford, eight one-thousandths of a Bitcoin. And you can subdivide it, you know, as far as you want, again, out to eight decimal points. So, but again, all it is just an entry on a digital ledger. There's nothing more than that to it.
With about a minute and a half left, let's sum it all up. Will all money be digital in 25 years? Will it be that you can kind of print money on a piece of paper? What's the world looking like in, let's say, 25 years?
I mean, look, I think that whether or not Bitcoin or cryptocurrency succeed, we are increasingly moving to a world in which our money is digital. I think what's interesting with Bitcoin is that central banks and banks are very interested in this technology, and they realize that this does provide a new way to generate and keep track and transact with money. And so, you know, there are several central banks in the world, including the Bank of England, Canada's central bank, that are playing with versions of Bitcoin and the Bitcoin blockchain to track their own currencies. So I think this is, you know, generally the direction that money is going. I don't think we're going to be paying for our coffee with Bitcoin, but I think Bitcoin might influence the way that we pay for our coffee.
So what you're saying is only buy what you can afford to lose because it's still pretty volatile, but this is the direction we're moving in.
Yeah, and Bitcoin is not the clear winner in that movement. Maybe it will be the winner, but it could just as well be the loser and go to nothing, and another competitor or another version of this software ends up being what matters.
Just a remarkable discussion. I feel so much smarter about this than I did just an hour ago. Thank you so much to Nathaniel Popper. He covers finance and technology from San Francisco for the New York Times. He's author of Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to the listeners for tuning in and for your emails and calls. Sorry we couldn't get to everybody. Coming up tomorrow, it's the Friday Media Roundtable. Your call is produced at KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and be sure to send some email ideas via yourcall@kalw.org. Laura Flynn is our producer. Lauren Schechter is the social media producer. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. It's Your Call.